stay tuned for To Your Health on WPVC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here are your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair.
Hey, good morning, good morning. Welcome to Your Health. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, MC. Good to see you again.
Yeah, always good to see you, my friend.
Thanks.
Hey, just to let everybody know, our mission at this show is to give you, the listener, the tools needed to make educated, healthy decisions in your daily life. And I just wanted to ask Larry, how was your Thanksgiving?
We had a terrific time. There were 16 of us at the table, wow. And my wife is an amazing organizer of these kinds of events. How about yours? How'd you do?
Oh, it was really great. It was actually just my wife and I.
A little quiet.
We have a wonderful relationship. And I did the turkey following Judy Rogers. Unfortunately, the late Judy Rogers of the Zunai Cafe out in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And she has a wonderful, wonderful recipe for turkey. If you're interested, I'll tell you what it is.
Yeah, sometime.
Anyway, people can Google Judy Bird, and they can get all that information. But, folks, it works so well. The turkey cooks quicker than normal, and everything's juicy and done right.
Yeah, I get to skip the responsibility for cooking the turkey. I get to pass that on.
Well, I talked to Susan, and she gave me that recipe, too, so we'll talk later.
Okay, well, we had a really interesting turkey this year, though. We had a European Black, which is one of the heritage breeds.
Oh.
Just fantastic. It also cooked faster than the official time, though.
Oh, I'll be darned.
I'm not knowledgeable on all that, so I'll skip on.
What farm did that come from, Larry?
Tall Cotton. Yeah. They are down at the Nelson Farmers Market. Mm-hmm. I've gotten to be friends with them to some extent, and they provided us turkeys now the last couple of years. It's just been great.
That's great.
We'll get them on the show at some point here to talk about their operation. They've had a rather difficult year moving their operation around. So I think we'll leave them till a little bit later.
More fun settled. To talk to them.
All right. So, I had a pretty interesting research time the last couple of days trying to pull together some interesting news and notes for the opening of the show here. And one of the things that I found, there we were talking poultry all weekend, was that researchers in Mexico have discovered the earliest evidence of turkey domestication down in Mexico.
I'll be darned.
I had no idea. Archaeologists have unearthed a clutch of domesticated turkey eggs used as a ritual offering in Oaxaca, Mexico, dated from 400 to 500 AD.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah, the turkeys, it turns out, were a really important food source for the Zapotec people who still live in the region and have lived there for thousands of years. They're not quite sure how many. These turkeys that they are eating right now, and the turkeys that they found the eggs from back in 400 to 500 AD, are very similar to the heritage birds that we're eating now. I had it Thanksgiving, so
wow.
I thought that was pretty cool.
My goodness, that is cool. Good Lord. A couple thousand-year-old eggs. No.
I really thought that the turkey was native to North America.
Yeah.
I really had no idea that there were turkeys down at Oaxaca, let alone that they'd already domesticated them. They didn't have pigs, sheep, cows, chickens.
Oh, my.
So the animal that they domesticated for food were turkeys.
A turkey, yeah, I'll be darned.
I love learning this stuff. I got to say, it's really part of the entertainment of the show here. What do you got on your list, Mike?
Well, I actually have a headline that I was reading about from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and they had a problem there. It seemed that 80 to 90% of their fresh fruits and vegetables came from outside New Mexico.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can certainly grow stuff there, you know. And so the city government tasked some folks to start a program called Grow the Growers. And so basically what it is through the university extension, the state university, they have an incubator program for budding farmers or for people that would like to look into farming. And they do, and it's all inclusive. It's a classroom education. Then once you finish your classroom education, which is, I think it's about 10 weeks, they go to in-field mentoring, and intensive internships with another farmer to learn the ins and outs of the actual farming. And then you learn the business in another incubator, if you will, that is totally business-oriented. And then they train you on entrepreneurship and giving you the ins and outs of that. And, of course, the mission is to give the local community access to locally grown fresh fruits and produce, increased economic development opportunities, and preservation of the land and the water, which is key, of course.
I suspect it's a pretty challenging environment out there to be growing in New Mexico.
Yeah, I
had family lived in Albuquerque for many years, about 25 years. I went out there fairly frequently. To describe it as dry would be to understate it by quite a bit. When they had a shower, it sometimes felt like it would dry before it quite got to the sidewalk.
That's almost like the showers in Hawaii, except they just last a very short period of time for the most part. Wow, that's amazing. So basically what they're doing also is giving people access to land and water that would otherwise be vulnerable to commercial development. Uh-huh. And so they want to allocate enough land out there to literally feed Albuquerque fresh fruits and vegetables. So, and of course, it's hot out there all the time, so they got a lot of sun.
Well, the history out there is pretty fascinating, too, because the Zuni people out in Chaco Canyon were farmers for a long time. Of course, they had to be farmers. It wasn't any other place to get food except for what they raised.
Yeah.
So they raised all their own food and survived out in a very dry environment. Mm-hmm. I've been out to Chaco Canyon. Many of you have been there, I'm sure. And if you haven't, you should go. It's an amazing place. It's really fantastic. And then they had one of those extended droughts.
Mm-hmm.
At least this is what they surmise. And the people all left.
Wow.
They had to abandon ship. They couldn't they couldn't provide for themselves. So it's a pretty tricky environment out there. It's great to see that the New Mexico government is putting some effort and energy into developing local food sources. Certainly there was a tremendous amount of growing over there out there for centuries, but when they have a drought, they have a drought.
Oh yeah. Yeah. well, from what I understand here in Charlottesville, there's a program run through the schools, which is, I believe the name is Schoolyard Gardens, and it's set up on a very similar model as to what they're doing in Berkeley, California, Edible Schoolyards. And so
that's the Alice Waters program?
It is the Alice Waters program, and actually she came out here. I contacted the Schoolyard Gardens folks, and they said that Alice came out here and gave them all sorts of help and pointers in setting up that Schoolyard Garden program.
Yeah.
Charlottesville High School is running it now, and the others will follow. I believe there are a couple. I don't know the names. But we will, folks, have those people from Schoolyard Gardens as guests here in a fairly short period of time, as soon as they get over their holiday festivities and, get going again in the next, part of the school year, second half of the school year, they'll be able to come here and really give us a good education. And folks, I got to tell you, if you can educate your kids to the advantages of farming, of growing their own vegetables and taking care of their own vegetables and produce, they'll teach their kids. I mean, that's how we are.
And again, it doesn't take a whole lot of space, a giant amount of room. You can grow a lot of really good food in very, very small spaces.
Really can.
I've seen people growing great tomatoes in baskets on urban terraces
and hay bales. Yeah. They use the right nutrients. You can feed the nutrients to the hay bale and just grow like crazy right out of the hay bale. It's amazing.
Yeah, that is, it's pretty amazing stuff. All right, well, let me tell you about one that I checked out also. This was pretty interesting. There was a new study published by the American Journal of Human Biology. Let me promise you, folks, I do not read the Journal of Human Biology. It's interesting to do research for the show, but that's above and beyond. All right, but the study was led by researchers from Yale and the University of Arizona, and they were trying to study exercise, get greater detail on the needs of exercise for human beings.
Important
the
for
importance
your
of it. Yep. Thank you. That's much better. All right, so the current guidelines are 150 minutes per week of moderate exercise, 2.5 hours, or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise. That's per week.
A week.
It's an hour and 15 minutes of vigorous exercise is the minimum, or 2.5 hours, essentially, of walking at a reasonable clip. So here's what they studied, which was really pretty interesting. There's a hunter-gatherer tribe in Tanzania that they've been studying for quite some time.
Oh, darn.
Small group.
Yeah.
The tribe is named the Hadza people, and they're subsistence hunting, foraging for berries, honey, tubers, and baobab fruit. Don't ask me what baobab fruit is. All right, so this is how these folks, that's what they make their living, and they are hunter-gatherers, so they are wanderers. And for years, researchers have been studying these people because there are last vestiges of those ancient, I want to call them civilizations. I think that's okay. So this tribe, they used 46 members of the tribe. They put heart monitors on them as they went about their daily business. The age ranges of the people were from young adults all the way up into their 70s. And here's what they discovered, that these people were actively moving for 2 hours a day. Maybe a little bit more. So in the end, that's not a heck of a lot. 2 hours, and yet, and also they weren't like running. They weren't chasing down lions, or they were moving at a relatively moderate rate, walking briskly, hustling, but not running around. Mm. 2 hours or more a day. They remained active right up into their 70s with amazing heart health, low blood pressure, excellent cholesterol levels, and certainly their diet has something to do with it. They aren't living a lot on, what is it, salt, fat, and sugar, the three food groups.
Right. Make anything taste like anything you want.
but nonetheless, they were extraordinarily healthy. It just emphasizes to me how, in the end, health is more than just diet.
Oh, yes.
Health is more than just what you eat. You got to move regularly. A brisk 20-minute walk a day, 15, 20 minutes around the block a few times, up and down the hill, it doesn't take a heck of a lot to keep ourselves a whole lot healthier.
Yeah. I actually Googled it. It said, Baobab, the ancient African fruit that fights diabetes. So,
well, there you go.
That's cool. It says three times vitamin C as an orange, twice as much calcium as milk, and tastes like a cross between a pineapple and a melon. What kind of melon? Watermelon.
Why aren't we seeing baobab? Is it that we can't pronounce it properly in the grocery stores?
Yeah, I know. It says it has been prized in Africa for centuries. It goes to what you were just saying. Let's see, creating range possibility, functional foods. Huh.
Sounds like a pretty interesting fruit.
Yeah, it really does. They've got a pretty picture in here, everything.
So we'll have to find it sometime.
Yeah, it's
I don't know where you'd even look. But
under health news through Google. That's what it is. Anyway. So do that if you're interested. It looks like a pretty good fruit.
We'll have to find it somewhere, I'd never even heard of it prior to researching
the
article.
They do call it a superfruit.
Okay.
So what else you got, Larry?
Well, I got a couple of fun ones.
Oh, good.
All right. So
I like fun.
So Domino's Pizza has just opened its first location in Milan, Italy. It's their first location in Italy. Now, if you've ever been to Italy, I've been there a couple times. I love it. The pizza is just fantastic. It's otherworldly. It has bears very little resemblance to what we eat.
It's true. I was in Italy and stationed there in the Navy. So, yeah.
And I can't see. Now, you know that a corporation like Domino's has done their research.
Oh, yeah.
They are not sort of randomly sticking a pizza restaurant in Italy without having done their homework. But I can't fathom it.
No.
Are Italians going to run to that gooey, super cheesy stuff?
Unhealthy. Not good.
As compared to the great pizza that they have everywhere around that country? You can't hardly go down the block without seeing another pizza place.
Well, the one thing that I found really interesting about their pizza out there, and folks, I will tell you that wheat in general is an inflammatory, and I suppose small amounts won't hurt anybody over the long haul, but their pizza over there, obviously, everything's fresh. They don't have the processing that we have here. You don't even get meat cheese, except in the cooler climates, because most places don't have refrigeration. So it's in a bucket out back in water.
Italians. Maybe that was so when you were in the Navy back in those 60s.
Oh, in 2003 or something.
But I think that by 2016, most of Italy has good refrigeration.
Well, I will say that was 70s. So
okay,
yeah,
it's almost 50 years now, Mike. Yeah, you're gonna have to. You gotta give those Italians a little credit.
Marcia, my wife, tells me all the time. I'll tell her a story and she'll say, "Yeah, what decade was that?" So I'm also. It's great. Keeps me on my toes.
All right. I got another one here.
All right.
Dude, Chipotle just got sued out in California for posting misleading calorie counts.
Oh, not a good idea.
Now, Chipotle, this is quite a string of bad news for poor Chipotle. Now, and I think they should get a lot of credit for posting the calorie counts of their food in their restaurants.
Yeah, important.
I think that that's a really helpful thing to do. Provided you do it honestly.
Yeah. And then the ingredients. So when you see a long list of ingredients and things you don't know, you can not eat it. It's your choice.
The story is that there were some customers in California and they saw a chorizo burrito advertised as having 300 calories and it had the works on it.
Mm.
They didn't believe it. Yeah. They took it home, analyzed it. And in fact, instead of the 300 calories, it had 1,055.
I was going to say 1,300, but yeah.
What that? So we're talking 3.5 times.
Yeah.
And so they now have sued them.
Good.
For false nutritional information. And it's deservedly so. Again, Chipotle deserves credit for posting this stuff, but be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell people if you're telling people what it is. Tell them the truth.
Well,
make decisions based on real information. They'll still come back to the store.
So true.
People like Chipotle, and even after all the bad news that they've had over the course of this year, it's still a reasonably strong company. People still go.
It is.
Just tell the truth.
Exactly. That's true. I have a friend that educated her students about reading labels. And, of course, gave them the information that sustainably grown or organically grown was the best way to eat. But if they couldn't find that, which is kind of hard these days, but to make sure you read those ingredients. And if you see this incredibly long line of ingredients, maybe you should rethink that choice. Even if it's so good tasting, it could maybe lead to something that you don't want.
Especially if that high fructose corn syrup is towards the top. When that's towards the top of the list, you really want to just put that back down and go find something else.
Well, this has sugar, and more sugar.
All right, so here's one more here I think we can fit in before the break.
Okay.
So the Sabra Dipping Company.
Mm-hmm.
This is all those great Sabra hummuses and such.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have a major recall on right now. a listeria problem. Mm. Listeria, let's see if I can say this right. Listeria monocytogenes have been found in a plant where the hummus is manufactured. So so far, nobody has gotten sick, but for an abundance of caution, they are recalling, let's see, all their hummus products produced before November 8th. And if consumers are urged to discard any product with a best before date of January 23rd.
And what was the brand?
This is Sabra hummus.
Sabra.
And this led me to the FDA website where all these recalls are listed. And I found this website to be really fascinating. I have never been on a government website before. And there I was on the FDA website, and if you just hit on recalls, you can see this whole list of various companies that are that have recalls on.
Good information.
Very, very important information. There are listeria issues with all sorts of ice creams I saw on there. I don't want to try to name the brands. I'm not here to castigate anybody. But for those of you who are interested in which products are sort of dangerous out there right now, go to the FDA website. It's a very quick visit, and you will get to see everything that is on recall right now. And
excellent. And we'll see you guys right after the break.
All right. We have a break coming up. And then who we got on the interview, Mike? Who's coming up on the interview?
We've got Carter Wallace from Farfield's Farm in Afton.
All right. Sounds great. All right. We'll see you all right after the break. Thanks for listening. Okay, we're back here.
Oh, we're back. Okay, yeah, I thought there were messages.
Yeah, I thought there were messages too, but I guess the message is that it's Larry and Mike here.
Yeah.
So I'm Larry Stopper and
MC Blair.
All right, we are back with To Your Health. We appreciate everybody listening today on WPVC. Mike,
really
we got an interview.
We do have an interview. Before that, I just wanted to say to the folks, you probably heard in the promo and in the intro that we're brought to you in part by Hamilton's, first in Maine. I just wanted you to know that those folks feature local produce, local and meat that they can get. A good place to go. The food is absolutely fabulous. Well, I was at the city market today, Larry.
Yeah.
And this morning,
okay,
actually
got up nice and early.
I did because, and I walked around. I helped a couple vendors set up their booths.
You did get there early.
I did, and so I talked to a guy. His name is Carter Wallace from Farfield's Farm in Afton, Virginia.
My hometown.
Your hometown. And
although there's no real town in my hometown.
That's right. There is no. Well, I heard, didn't they get a traffic light at some point?
No, not yet. No, okay, no. That's down in the metropolis of Lovingston.
Of Lovingston. Yeah, they do have one down there, don't they? You know, I remember when they put it in, actually. But the Carter, he used to be and he says it in the interview, but he's from L.A. originally, used to be a musician out there professionally, but he also taught schoolyard gardens. He was one of the instructors in that program for schools. He has a romance with the soil. And what it can produce. That's what it's about. So without further ado, let's play that interview.
All right. Well, let's hear what he had to say.
MC Blair here. I'm at the city market here in Charlottesville on Water Street. I'm talking to Carter Wallace from Farfield Farm in Afton, Virginia. And just tell us a little bit about the farm, Carter.
Well, Farfield's, it's our second year in commercial production. Second year here at the market. We do grass-finished beef, organic soy-free eggs. We also have a certified organic plant nursery that focuses on Chinese medicinals and otherwise useful plants. Medicinals, edibles, and otherwise usefuls is the kind of useful plants is the kind of branding. And we do a little bit of veg. And for ourselves, we do things like bees and stuff. But so here at the market, we sell beef and eggs.
Yeah. Beef and eggs mainly, yeah.
This year.
Yeah.
Last year, we focused on vegetables, but this year, we're doing mostly the beef.
Mostly beef and eggs. Well, I can attest they're really good, good stuff.
And thanks.
So your beef are 100% grass-fed, finished all the way from calf to slaughter, right?
Yep, that's right. And more than that, we pride ourselves in the special attention we pay to the management of the animals, which I think is one of the things that differs our operation from a lot of them. But although there's some great operations here in Charlottesville, we're blessed to have folks like Timber Creek and Silky Cow and other great folks who really understand how to manage animals for the sake of sequestering carbon and for the sake of the animal's health. So for the animal performance and for the sake of regenerating the landscape, we practice what is called holistic planned grazing. So it's a whole philosophy, but also has certain practices that people like rotational grazing.
Right.
Some people think of it as mob grazing. It's a little more complicated than that. That's what we practice.
Yeah. Well, I know one farmer, they get a fresh pasture every day, moves them around, and then his egg layers go in behind the bovines and scratch through the pies and eat the larva. And...
Yeah, that's what we do as well.
And that's great.
It's a great pattern that expresses itself all over the world, and we're happy to copy it.
Yeah, so it prevents overgrazing, right? Because it seems like you go by some of these farms and the grass is all maybe an inch high, and they're still, and it's brown, and they're still grazing on the same grass every day, and you guys kind of the opposite of that, right?
Yeah. I could talk all day about the joys of managing grass.
Wow.
But yes, it is for the sake of limiting overgrazing. Yeah.
So you came from L.A. You were a musician out there, and also you had a food show, I understand.
That's true. Yeah. Those things are true, yeah.
That's cool.
So I was a professional musician. I wanted to be a father and to prioritize family and also prioritize being a part of the solution to so many of the urgent problems that we all know are around us. So
yeah.
I love being a musician. I love all the things that I got to experience as a musician, but earning my livelihood from the music industry wasn't exactly what I was feeling right for, either for being a father or for really plugging into climate issues and environmental issues. So I am still on a path and a journey that started with articulating that I wanted to get in right relationship with Mother Earth. And so that awesome. Led me to, first of all, volunteering in the school garden context. I was a school garden teacher. Those opportunities turned into a radio show. I was involved in community organizing around food justice issues, food sovereignty, and various things in LA. And then my sympathies were gradually broader and broader in acre and broader and broader in scope, to include more sort of like, you know, governmental policy, but particularly carbon sequestration on broad acre scale. So things that farmers can do right now to sequester carbon, which for me is a focus on agroforestry and holistic planned grazing. So that's where my heart is at. In addition to some other, you know, deep romances with bees and dairy, for example.
Oh, but, man.
So there's a lot of fronts that lead me to the farm life. I'm an advocate for agrarian culture through and through, morning to night. So yeah, so that's why we do with this. It's not, you know, the fact that beef comes out of it is great, but really for me what it's about is building topsoil.
That's it, the soil. Yeah. John Whiteside from Wolf Creek is a big advocate of the soil. And,
absolutely.
And of course,
I think the satisfaction comes not from limiting our carbon footprint, but from having a handprint bigger than one's footprint. And were it not for certain issues around the processing of animals and the transportation of them, which are often government regulated and enforced, that I have to drive them to, you know, some town and get them processed at a USDA facility, were it not for those parts in the food chain, it is a very regenerative thing that we do to
sustainable.
Produce this beef. It's beyond sustainable.
Beyond sustainable.
Nobody, I once heard quipped, nobody boasts about their sustainable marriage. They boast about their love and infusion and the regenerative capacity of their marriage, right? So in that way, we fall in love with not sustainability, but with regeneration. Both of our soils, but also the culture that stewards the soils, because we've seen for quite a long time and continuing to this day the mass migration from the countryside to the city, following with it not only people, but culture, practices, skills, ideas, but also nutrients. So carbon, mineral, carbon cycles, nutrient cycles, water cycles flowing to the cities to be flushed into the Chesapeake, for example. And so we advocate the regeneration of the countryside, the regeneration of culture that sustains us beyond the lure of the industrial.
That's fantastic. That really is. Wow. You're located in Afton, is that correct?
We are located in beautiful Afton, right actually in this in a geological zone that's extra complex. We are at the ecotone where the Blue Ridge and the Piedmont meet. Actually divides the property evenly. So we get to delight in that geology, but also the various ecosystems. On the farm, we have ponds and forests and pasture and the interaction between all three. We are buzzing with dragonflies. Bear visit us and all kinds of wildlife that we are proud to steward and welcome.
So would you be a guest on our show at some point?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, good.
It'd be
good.
An honor.
Like to have you. Definitely like to have you.
Of course, yeah.
Thanks, Carter.
That was Carter Wallace from Farfield's Farm in beautiful Afton, Virginia. This is To Your Health. Right here on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, 94.7. Larry, what did you think about that interview?
I was pretty impressed, Mike, but I wanted you to finish that and introduce yourself. Make sure to remind people that you are MC Blair.
I am MC Blair. And I'm
Larry Stopper.
And Larry Stopper, my co-host. That's wonderful. Right here on To Your Health.
All right. So that was pretty impressive,
impressive,
to say the least. I'm looking forward to meeting him.
Well, yeah, it's possible we'll go out Tuesday afternoon, folks, and Larry and I will meet him, and we're going to have a lot more from him. He sounds like somebody that has so much knowledge and a real passion for what he does. And let's face it, that's the kind of person I want to learn from.
I'm sort of embarrassed in some ways. He's my neighbor. He must be about 4 or 5 miles away from me. I don't even know he exists. And it's interesting that he's choosing to come to the Charlottesville market and not out to the Nellisford market. It's an interesting
Choice.
There you go. That's the right word. The Nellisford market is very, very popular in Nelson County. I mean, you have to get there early to get to sometimes even get a good parking place.
It's true.
It can be crazy over the summer.
And also, you know, the vendors out there, wonderful, wonderful food, properly grown, properly raised animals. But they're limited. They don't, they don't have thousands and thousands of products to sell.
Right.
You know, they have maybe 100 or so, and so you got to get there early if you're going
to
go out.
Let's go back to that interview because he is a fascinating guy.
Yeah,
Just when he's talking about that geologic zone, I haven't in mind the place. I can see it as my house looks right out to the eastern slope of the Blue Ridge, mm-hmm. so I'm looking towards where he must be. I think he's a little bit further north of where I am in the valley.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing spot to live right there. When you live on the western side of Route 151, mm-hmm. for those of you that are familiar with heading down Route 151 on the way to Wintergreen and down to some of the great breweries that we all enjoy out there, if you live on the western side of 151, you see a lot more interesting wildlife. You have more interesting interactions with them because they're coming out off the Blue Ridge. They're coming off the Parkway area, the National Forest, the National Park. On the eastern side of the Blue Ridge, we don't see it so much. In fact, we see it substantially less. For instance, I've lived there 41 years. I've never seen a rattlesnake. On my side of the Blue Ridge. And yet, I know that they're relatively plentiful just on the western side of 151. It's its own unnatural barrier in its own way.
I'll be darned.
So it's just kind of interesting to hear him. Although I did have a bear encounter this year. We don't have to talk about bears. I don't want to get away from Carter's interview.
Exactly.
But I did get pretty darn close to a bear this year, which was not my intention at all.
You're listening to Your Health. I'm MC Blair. My co-host is Larry Stopper. And I just wanted to, we just had an interview from Carter Wallace at Farfield's Farm, and he talked about the soil being the main thing. The soil's the thing, if you will, because obviously if your soil isn't healthy, full of nutrients, doesn't matter what you try to grow on that, not going to be very good for you,
yeah.
You know. And so to keep the, as he said, he wanted his handprint to be bigger than his footprint.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I've never heard that stated that way. We always talk about the carbon footprint or, you know, whatever. And so that just really brings into focus, for me, it brings into focus what you really do is get your hands, you know, embrace what you're doing. And obviously good management of the soil, good husbandry with the animals.
And a deep appreciation for the animals that he's raising.
Oh, yeah.
That he's eventually going to send to be, let's put it politely, harvested
yes.
for their meat.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that that's really beautiful. I think that it takes a special person to be able to develop a bond with the animals that they're raising, that they're eventually going to slaughter. It's very difficult. I raised a beef cow myself with my now ex-wife about 25 years ago. We live on a fairly spacious piece of property. Mm-hmm. And we had milk cows for years.
Yeah.
And we decided when we had a male calf, we had always sold it. We decided we would raise the calf and harvest its meat. And we raised that calf for about 15 months. And at the end of 15 months, he was a rambunctious child. a 1,000-pound rambunctious child. A dangerous,
yeah.
rambunctious child. And we loved him in his way,
yeah.
and it was painfully
painful.
Sad to send him off. We had to send him off. He was out of control. He was so big. When we would bring a bucket of grain, if we needed to change his pasture, we would lead him from pasture to pasture with a bucket of grain.
Mm-hmm.
Holy mackerel, when you have a 1,000-pound steer charging
yeah.
at you for his bucket of grain.
Right.
Boy, you really want to stay a few steps away.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine.
It's like a kid. You're afraid he was going to jump up on you like a dog. But when the point of the story actually is that when came back from the slaughterhouse, we couldn't bring ourselves to eat the meat.
No.
No, we gave or sold it all.
Oh,
we could not. We felt affection.
Did you name him?
We did. I don't remember.
Okay,
honestly,
well.
It's 25 years. I don't remember his name. I just remember that it was impossible for us to eat.
Yeah.
We just couldn't bring ourselves to do it. So the point of the story is simply that if you can develop that kind of appreciation and understanding of your animals, and at the same time accept that you're going to send them off to be turned into a product, and still raise them with the love and appreciation both of the animal and of the land and how you're doing it, as Carter obviously has, it's very impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you guys heard, but we didn't stay on it, didn't elaborate on it, but he mentioned bees. They do have their own hives, and as most of you know, I hope, they are totally
endangered.
Necessary. They're endangered, absolutely, but they're totally necessary for crop production.
Yeah.
If you don't have your pollinators, you don't. You're done. You know, nothing happened. Einstein mentioned that if the bee population were to disappear, that the human population would follow closely.
Yes, no question.
I mean, just a few years. So they are endangered. The closest we can come right now is they've been eating pesticides, and that's what's killing them.
Yeah.
And it's just a real shame. But there are pesticides out there that are developed from geraniums, for instance. Last week we heard, or I had an interview with a guy from Broadhead Farm, Wally Parks, and he mentioned that there are several natural pesticides that if you use them, you can still be certified organic.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't want to pay the certification, your food is still excellent to eat. It's sustainably grown. And so Carter did mention that they do their own bees, and they also mentioned the, what was it? those buzzing...
Dragonflies.
Dragonflies, that's it.
Dragonflies.
Excuse me, but dragonflies, yes. and are they pollinators, do you know?
No, I don't think they're pollinators.
They're not. They're
I don't think so, but they're just fantastic for the overall ambiance of life out in the country.
Okay.
So I got a quick bee story. I know that we're coming up on a break again here in just a moment, but when I was quite young, I was enthralled by the idea of raising bees and having my own honey. But I got... And when you get a hive of bees, they're fairly domesticated and fairly calm, as long as you handle them right. But I was a bit too casual with those bees, and one day I was showing them off to a date that I had, and I lifted the lid wrong, and I had a T-shirt on, and I got so stung. I must have gotten about a dozen stings, including a couple on my lip.
Oh.
I went into hiding for a few days
until
the size of my lip came down, and I developed a great deal of appreciation and respect for the fact that domesticated bees are domesticated only in the broadest sense of the word.
That's exactly right. They can't have them for pets.
They are not exactly like a cat or dog.
That was good, Larry. You're listening to Your Health with MC Blair and Larry Stopper. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back on the other side.
Thanks so much for listening. Hey, I'm going to jump in right there before MC grabs that microphone and starts to talk to you about sustainability and tell you that the PVC Let There Be Light evening is fantastic. I did it with my wife and a few friends last year. Oh my God, did we have fun. It's a great time. So let me just throw in my own little endorsement above that PSA.
Oh, wow. Cool. I've been reading that PSA over the airways, that's really good to get that kind of an endorsement.
Yeah.
You're listening to Your Health. I'm MC Blair, my co-host Larry Stopper. I think Larry has something we'd like to end. We're basically just giving you the tools necessary to make educated, healthy decisions in your daily life. That's what we do here on To Your Health.
And we are sponsored today by Hamilton's on 1st and Main.
Hamilton's.
We appreciate their sponsorship a great deal. Good food, actually great food, great people.
Yeah, absolutely, and they do feature local produce and meats.
And meats, yeah. So we appreciate their support very much.
Sure do.
All right, so we're going to spend this last segment here talking about local, since Mike just brought it right up with Hamilton's, and sustainability. It's a broad subject. We could go on for hours. Mike and I sat in my living room yesterday and talked sustainability until it was time to go. Because it's so broad. I'm going to give you Michael Pollan's definition of it. You can twist it any way you want. The way he says it is that sustainable agriculture refers to a way of farming that can be continued indefinitely because it conforms to the terms imposed upon it by the nature of places and the nature of people. Wikipedia says it's a site-specific integrated system of plant and animal production that lasts over the long term. And, of course, long term is what counts.
It is.
And I mean, that's what sustainability is all about. Mike, you got something right there you wanted to
throw in? Well, I just wanted to elaborate on that just a little bit and mention that long-term is not 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Long-term is your grandchildren and great-grandchildren are getting the benefits of that same land. And unfortunately, that's what we think about. Everything is short term. What can you do for me now?
Well, quarterly.
Yeah, exactly. Quarterly. The stockholders, you know, give me those dividends. Well, I just wanted to, organic foods. What you need to know about eating organic foods.
All right. We'll start there, and then we'll morph right back to our sustainability.
Oh yeah. Okay. Right. Absolutely. Well, I just want it's pretty popular local foods. It's the fastest growing market. In 2015, they recorded $43 billion in sales. It went up from 11. It went up 11%. Fresh juices and drinks were up 33%, making that the fastest growing subcategory. And as you can well imagine, snack foods are still popular. Big surprise, but more and more folks are eating organic snack foods, and to that I say wahoo, because that's important. You know, big box stores, supermarket chains are adding more organic products. You guys have probably seen more organic products in your supermarket if that's where you shop. I like to shop at the farmer's market, but sometimes you do have to go into the into a grocery store. They know industry-wide they need to build a more secure supply chain that can support the demand. So there's more acreage being dedicated to organic growth, believe it or not, which is really, really good. And you can imagine Big Ag is fighting them every step of the way.
Well, but Big Ag is joining in now on the organic movement, and they're sort of honing in on it. And that's part of the back to local that seems to be so important right now, or certainly I want to say it's really important to me, because it's very easy to get sucked into the I buy organic and that's what I eat and it comes from the grocery store and I feel righteous.
Yeah.
And they're skewing the definition of organic, and it's not organic has that aura of sustainability, but you're not maintaining any sense of sustainability if you're eating organic grapes from Chile in the winter.
Right.
If you're eating organic almonds from California. They're great. I love them. But we've got, in order to make the system work, as Mike says, for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, the system has to be, our consumption within the system has to be modified in some way. So yeah, sure, we can enjoy the treats every now and then from some faraway place, but we can't live on them as the mainstays of our diet.
That's very true. Becoming more of a locavore, if you will.
Yes.
Only local organic products. Or local sustainably grown products that are in season.
As much as possible. As much as possible. You're not going to get away from enjoying chocolate.
Nope.
it's not going to happen. And we don't grow any cacao anywhere close by. That's reality. So we can't, we're not trying to be purists here, but the more that you can eat locally, whether sustainably grown, organic, the more you're lowering your carbon footprint overall. And our carbon footprint is what's making us, is what's screwing us right now, I guess. Our carbon footprints are ridiculous. I've put solar panels up on my roof. I have a solar panel, hot water heater on my house. I drive a hybrid. My carbon footprint is still vastly exaggerated from what it could be in order to maintain this earth over a long term. And the discussion that Mike and I were having the other day is because I was reading the news about the flooding down in North Carolina.
Yeah.
All right. And there are huge factory farms down there raising pigs mostly. They keep the waste in these god-awful lagoons.
Pink.
I have no idea how they turn pink, but pink they are. Well, the flooding from Hurricane Matthew overflowed dozens, if not hundreds, of these lagoons, washing incredibly toxic fecal matter and all sorts of other stuff into three or four of the different rivers down there. I know it was the Neuse River, the New River, and I think there's the Lincoln, but I'm not positive of the third one. But they're washing this horrible toxic mess right into their neighbors' watersheds and out into the ocean. Now, and the debate we're having is, so how do you feed a world of 7.5 billion people on its way to 9 billion plus? How do you feed that number of people without factory farming? Is it possible? Can we do it by being locavores?
I know there are a few people in this area that have models that will work for the world, definitely for the nation, but also for the entire world. And there is a fella in at UVA right now. He's going to be a guest here, folks, right here on To Your Health with MC Blair and Larry Stopper at 94.7. And he's built these affordable units that use hydroponics, but the hydroponics have all the nutrients needed to raise whatever plants you're planting, and it's on a very small scale. You can plant up to 80 plants, and that will feed a family their fresh produce, lettuces, spinach, tomatoes, whatever they want to plant in there, year-round.
They're greenhouse units?
And they're greenhouse units, and I can't say the name right now. He's getting patents, so that would kind of screw things up. But they're selling. They're going to sell for somewhere in the $500 range, which most hydroponic systems now are running, you know, up to $2,000, $2,500. So this will be able to be used by a family, a small family, and that alone will solve a lot of urban growing and
backyard
and
growing, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I'm a big advocate of that.
And the nice thing about it, and we will have him as a guest. He definitely wants to come on. Is that it's built out of good wood and it looks like a fine piece of furniture, so it fits right in your living room if that's where you wanted to put it, or your storage room.
Wait,
or
wait a second, is it a greenhouse you can put in your living room?
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing. You know, it'll look amazing because it's got wonderful wood, so it'll fit right into any decor.
As a woodworker, I got to get close to these things and check this stuff out.
And then, you know, a lot of people in the apartments have a porch or a deck or something or rooftop that they can put these on. So it's coming. Those kind of things are coming. But I'll tell you what,
thinking about these.
They're working on answers to these things. Joel Salatin out in Swope, Virginia, he's written a bunch of books. He's really doing it right, folks. And he has a model already in place. It works with, you know, other farmers. You know, one farmer raises this, one farmer raises these, two or three things, whatever. They all share within the community, and it can be done. And, of course, there's the local food hub, a movement that's going throughout the United States. Those guys, they contact the farmers. For you folks that you don't have time to go to the farmer's market, they deliver, you know, into local area or
centralized locations,
and then you just go there and pick up your boxes,
yeah.
Whatever it is, and you order it online. So that I think with that and the movement towards organic and sustainability, that is going to go a long way to solving that problem.
Well, it's a problem that we're going to have to solve. I'm pretty staggered by it when I look at it, because I know that factory farms are bad.
Oh, yeah.
We know that this is a very poor way, health-wise for the animals, health-wise for the people, and yet they produce cheap food.
They do, but it's at a very high cost.
It's interesting, too, because you can say that, and it's true. It's a high cost, particularly to their neighbors.
Yes.
These folks down in rural North Carolina, I'm pretty sure it's central North Carolina, they get the worst of this. They've got the farms near them. They smell terrible. Their water gets contaminated.
Well,
and yet it produces cheap food that the people in, I don't know, New Mexico, Idaho, they get to eat.
Right.
And they don't have any effects from it.
Well, actually, the health effects are tremendous, eating a factory-farmed animal.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to say, I was reading about this farmer in, he's a factory farmer in Iowa. And the article was slanted towards this was a good deal for the farmer.
Yeah.
And folks, I want to ask you. He had to invest $750,000, $750,000. He raises 1.2 million chickens in a year, and he makes $30,000 income. Now, he's $750,000 in debt. He's only getting $30,000. That's about a 3% return on his money. And I just wonder if any of the CEOs of those large corporations would be happy with a 3% return. I don't think so.
3% is pretty painful.
It's pretty painful, especially on a $750,000 investment for a family.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of debt to carry. And I'll bet he's not real happy. $30,000, are you kidding me? You know, maybe a single person can live on that. But, you know, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So that's the other downside of factory farming. Not only are they producing unhealthy animals that are not good for you due to antibiotics and other things, but they're also not helping the farmer who's doing it, you know. And whereas if you're doing local and buying local, example, a farmer does 2,000 birds, not 1.2 million, 2,000 birds, and from that makes $6,000 selling them local. On moss,
yeah,
and selling them locally.
Yeah.
Now they make more than that, but after you take away all the money that they spend and the time and their labor and all that, they net about $3 a bird. That's okay,
yeah.
You know. And of course, if you're 2,000 birds, you also maybe do pork and beef or produce and whatnot. So that's a big cause or a great idea or reason for making sure you keep that money in the local community.
All right, I want to throw out one little fast fact here that sort of stunned me in the research on this subject here. So it's estimated that in the next 50 years, the global food system is likely to need to produce as much food as it did in the previous 10,000 years combined.
Oh, boy.
So it's a big task in front of the farmers of our world.
It is, and you guys can help by you know, going to the farmers markets, the city market, and buying locally when at all possible. And here on To Your Health, we're going to have some recipes that will show you that you can actually stretch those dollars by not using as much protein, your meats and whatnot, in your recipes, so and still get delicious, wonderful, healthy food for you and your family.
All right. Well, I can hear the music in the background, so that means that To Your Health is on its way out. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you listening. This is Larry Stopper.
And MC Blair.
You're listening to 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, WPVC. Stay tuned for Club El Sabor. I got to tell you, it's some great Latin music. I love heading out of the studio here, dancing away to that music. Thanks so much for listening to everybody. We will see you again next week.
Thanks again. To Your Health.
You've been listening to Your Health with your hosts, Larry Stopper and MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.